Chapter 3 The Human Disciple. Such, then, is the divine teacher of the Gita, the eternal avatar, the divine who has descended into the human consciousness, the Lord seated within the heart of all beings. He who guides from behind the veil all our thought and action and heart seeking, even as he directs from behind the veil of visible and sensible forms and forces and tendencies the great universal action of the world, which he has manifested in his own being. All the strife of our upward endeavor and seeking finds its culmination and ceases in a satisfied fulfillment when we can rend the veil and get behind our apparent self to this real self, can realize our whole being in this true Lord of our being, can give up our personality to and into this one real person, merge our ever dispersed and ever converging mental activities into his splendory light, offer up our errant and struggling will and energies into his vast, luminous, and undivided will, at once renounce and satisfy all our dissipated outward moving desires and emotions in the plenitude of his self-existent bliss. This is the world teacher, of whose eternal knowledge all other highest teaching is but the various reflection and partial word. This the voice to which the hearing of our soul has to awaken. Arjuna, the disciple, who receives his initiation on the battlefield, is a counterpart of this conception. He is the type of the struggling human soul who has not yet received the knowledge, but has grown fit to receive it by action in the world, in a close companionship and an increasing nearness to the higher and divine self in humanity. There is a method of explaining the Gita in which not only this episode, but the whole Mahabharata is turned into an allegory of the inner life and has nothing to do with our outward human life and action, but only with the battles of the soul and the powers that strive within us for possession. That is a view which the general character and the actual language of the epic does not justify, and, if pressed, would turn the straightforward philosophical language of the Gita into a constant, laborious, and somewhat puerile mystification. The language of the Veda, and part at least of the Puranas, is plainly symbolic, full of figures and concrete representations of things that lie behind the veil. But the Gita is written in plain terms and professes to solve the great ethical and spiritual difficulties which the life of man raises. And it will not do to go behind this plain language and thought and rest them to the service of our fancy. But there is this much of truth in the view that the setting of the doctrine, though not symbolical, is certainly typical, as indeed the setting of such a discourse as the Gita must necessarily be, if it has to have any relation at all with that which it frames. Arjuna, as we have seen, is the representative man of a great world struggle and divinely guided movement of men and nations. In the Gita, he typifies the human soul of action, brought face to face through that action in its highest and most violent crisis with the problem of human life and its apparent incompatibility with the spiritual state or even with a purely ethical ideal of perfection. Arjuna is the fighter in the chariot with the divine Krishna as his charioteer. In the Veda also, we have this image of the human soul and the divine riding in one chariot through a great battle to the goal of a high aspiring effort. But there it is a pure figure and symbol. The divine is there, Indra, the master of the world of light and immortality. The power of divine knowledge which descends to the aid of the human seeker battling with the sons of falsehood, darkness, limitation, mortality. The battle is with spiritual enemies who bar the way to the higher world of our being. And the goal is that plane of vast being, resplendent with the light of the supreme truth, and uplifted to the conscious immortality of the perfected soul, of which Indra is the master. The human soul is Kutsa, he who constantly seeks the seer knowledge, as his name implies. And he is the son of Arjuna or Arjuni, the white one, child of Switra, the white mother. He is, that is to say, the sattvic or purified and light-filled soul, which is open to the unbroken glories of the divine knowledge. And when the chariot reaches the end of its journey, the own home of Indra, the human Kutsa has grown into such an exact likeness of his divine companion that he can only be distinguished by Sachi, the wife of Indra, because she is truth-conscious. The parable is evidently of the inner life of man. It is a figure of human growing into the likeness of the eternal divine by the increasing illumination of knowledge. But the Gita starts from action, and Arjuna is the man of action and not of knowledge, the fighter, never the seer or the thinker. From the beginning of the Gita, this characteristic temperament of the disciple is clearly indicated and it is maintained throughout. It becomes first evident in the manner in which he is awakened to the sense of what he is doing, the great slaughter of which he is to be the chief instrument, in the thoughts which immediately rise in him, in the standpoint and the psychological motives which make him recoil from the whole terrible catastrophe. They are not the thoughts, the standpoint, the motives of a philosophical or even of a deeply reflective mind or a spiritual temperament confronted with the same or a similar problem. They are those, as we might say, of the practical or the pragmatic man, the emotional, sensational, moral and intelligent human being, not habituated to profound and original reflection or any sounding of the depths, accustomed rather to high but fixed standards of thought and action, and a confident treading through all vicissitudes and difficulties, who now finds all his standards failing him and all the basis of his confidence in himself and his life shone away from under him at a single stroke. That is the nature of the crisis which he undergoes. Arjuna is, in the language of the Gita, a man subject to the action of the three gunas, or modes of the nature force, and habituated to move unquestioningly in that field, like the generality of men. He justifies his name only in being so far pure and sattvic as to be governed by high and clear principles and impulses, and habitually control his lower nature by the noblest law which he knows. He is not a violent asuric disposition, not the slave of his passions, but has been trained to a high calm and self-control, to an unswerving performance of his duties and firm obedience to the best principles of the time and society in which he has lived, and the religion and ethics to which he has been brought up. He is egoistic like other men, but with a purer or sattvic egoism, which regards the moral law and society and claims of others and not only or predominantly his own interests, desires and passions. He has lived and guided himself by the Shastra, the moral and social code. The thought which preoccupies him, the standard which he obeys, is the Dharma, that collective Indian conception of the religious, social and moral rule of conduct, and especially the rule of the station and function to which he belongs. He, the Kshatriya, the high-minded, self-governed, chivalrous prince and warrior and leader of Aryan men. Following always this rule, conscious of virtue and right dealing, he has travelled so far and finds suddenly that it has led him to become the protagonist of a terrific and unparalleled slaughter, a monstrous civil war involving all the cultured Aryan nations, which must lead to the complete destruction of the flower of their manhood and threatens their ordered civilization with chaos and collapse. It is typical again of the pragmatic man that it is through his sensations that he awakens to the meaning of his action. He has asked his friend and charioteer to place him between the two armies, not with any profounder idea, but with the proud intention of viewing and looking in the face these myriads of the champions of unrighteousness whom he has to meet and conquer and slay in this holiday of fight, so that the right may prevail. It is, as he gazes, that the revelation of the meaning of a civil and domestic war comes home to him, a war in which not only men of the same race, the same nation, the same clan, but those of the same family and household stand upon opposite sides, all whom the social man holds most dear and sacred, he must meet as enemies and slay. The worshipped teacher and preceptor, the old friend, comrade and companion in arms, grandsires, uncles, those who stood in the relation to him of father, of son, of grandson, connections by blood and connections by marriage, all these social ties have to be cut asunder by the sword. It is not that he did not know these things before, but he has never realized it all. Obsessed by his claims and wrongs and by the principles of his life, the struggle for the right, the duty of the Kshatriya to protect justice and the law, and fight and beat down injustice and lawless violence, he has neither thought it out deeply nor felt it in his heart and at the core of his life. And now, it is shown to his vision by the divine charioteer, placed sensationally before his eyes, and comes home to him like a blow delivered at the very center of his sensational, vital, and emotional being. The first result is a violent sensational and physical crisis, which produces a disgust of the action and its material objects and of life itself. He rejects the vital aim pursued by egoistic humanity in its action, happiness and enjoyment. He rejects the vital aim of the Kshatriya, victory and rule and power and the government of men. What, after all, is this fight for justice when reduced to its practical terms, but just this, a fight for the interests of himself, his brothers and his party, for possession and enjoyment and rule? But at such a cost, these things are not worth having, for they are of no value in themselves, but only as a means to the right maintenance of social and national life. And it is these very aims that in the person of his kin and his race he is about to destroy. And then comes the cry of the emotions. These are they for whose sake life and happiness are desired, our own people, Who would consent to slay these for the sake of all the earth, or even for the kingdom of the three worlds? What pleasure can there be in life, what happiness, what satisfaction in oneself after such a deed? The whole thing is a dreadful sin. For now, the moral sense awakens to justify the revolt of the sensations and the emotions. It is a sin. There is no right nor justice in mutual slaughter. Especially at those who are to be slain, the natural objects of reverence and of love, those without whom one would not care to live. And to violate these sacred feelings can be no virtue, can be nothing but a heinous crime. Granted that the offense, the aggression, the first sin, the crimes of greed and selfish passion which have brought things to such a pass came from the other side, yet armed resistance to wrong under such circumstances would be itself a sin and crime worse than theirs because they are blinded by passion and unconscious of guilt. While on this side, it would be with a clear sense of guilt that the sin would be committed. And for what? For the maintenance of family morality? Of the social law and the law of the nation? These are the very standards that will be destroyed by this civil war. The family itself will be brought to the point of annihilation. Corruption of morals and loss of purity of race will be engendered. The eternal laws of the race and moral law of the family will be destroyed. Ruin of the race, the collapse of its high traditions, ethical degradation, and hell for the authors of such a crime. These are the only practical results possible of this monstrous civil strife. Therefore, cries Arjuna, casting down the divine bow and inexhaustible quiver given to him by the gods for that tremendous hour, "It is more for my welfare that the sons of Dhritarashtra armed should slay me unarmed and unresisting. I will not fight." The character of this inner crisis is therefore not the questioning of the thinker. It is not a recoil from the appearances of life and a turning of the eye inward in search of truth of things, the real meaning of existence and a solution or an escape from the dark riddle of the world. It is the sensational, emotional, and moral revolt of man hitherto satisfied with action and its current standards, who find himself cast by them into a hideous chaos, where they are in violent conflict with each other and with themselves, and there is no moral standing ground left, nothing to lay hold of and walk by, no dharma. That for the soul of action in the mental being is the worst possible crisis, failure and overthrow. The revolt itself is the most elemental and simple possible. Sensationally, the elemental feeling of horror, pity and disgust. Vitally, the loss of attraction and faith in the recognized and familiar objects of action and aims of life. Emotionally, the recoil of the ordinary feelings of social man, affection, reverence, desire of a common happiness and satisfaction, from a stern duty outraging them all. Morally, the elementary sense of sin and hell and rejection of blood-stained enjoyments. Practically, the sense that the standards of action have led to a result which destroys the practical aims of action. But the whole upshot is that all-embracing inner bankruptcy which Arjuna expresses when he says that his whole conscious being, not the thought alone, but heart and vital desires and all, are utterly bewildered and can find nowhere the dharma, nowhere any valid law of action. For this alone he takes refuge as a disciple with Krishna. "Give me," he practically asks, "that which I have lost, a true law, a clear rule of action, a path by which I can again confidently walk." He does not ask for the secret of life or of the world, the meaning and purpose of it all, but for adharma. Yet it is precisely this secret for which he does not ask, or at least so much of the knowledge as is necessary to lead him into a higher life, to which the divine teacher intends to lead this disciple. For he means him to give up all dharmas, except the one broad and vast rule of living consciously in the divine and acting from that consciousness. Therefore, after testing the completeness of his revolt from the ordinary standards of conduct, he proceeds to tell him much that has to do with the state of the soul, but nothing of any outward rule of action. He must be equal in soul, abandon the desire of the fruits of work, rise above his intellectual notions of sin and virtue, live and act in yoga with a mind in samadhi firmly fixed, that is to say, in the divine alone. Arjuna is not satisfied. He wishes to know how the change to this state will affect the outward action of the man, what result it will have on his speech, his movements, his state, what difference it will make in this acting living human being. Krishna persists merely in enlarging upon the ideas he has already brought forward, on the soul state behind the action, not on the action itself. It is the fixed anchoring of the intelligence in a state of desireless equality that is the one thing needed. Arjuna breaks out impatiently, for here is no rule of conduct such as he sought, but rather, as it seems to him, the negation of all action. If thou holdest the intelligence to be greater than action, why then dost thou appoint me to an action terrible in its nature? Thou bewilderest my understanding with a mingled word. Speak one thing decisively, by which I can attain to what is the best. It is always the pragmatic man who has no value for metaphysical thought or for the inner life except when they help him to his one demand, adharma, a law of life in the world, or if need be, of leaving the world, for that too is a decisive action which he can understand. But to live and act in the world, yet be above it, this is a mingled and confusing word, the sense of which he has no patience to grasp. The rest of Arjuna's questions and utterances proceed from the same temperament and character. When he is told that once the soul state is assured, there need be no apparent change in the action, he must act always by the law of his nature, even if the act itself seem faulty and deficient compared with that of another law than his own, he is troubled. The nature? But what of this sense of sin in the action with which he is preoccupied? Is it not this very nature which drives men as if by force and even against their better will into sin and guilt? His practical intelligence is baffled by Krishna's assertion that it was he who in ancient times revealed to Vivaswan this yoga, since lost, which he is now again revealing to Arjuna, and by his demand for an explanation, he provokes the famous and oft-quoted statement of avatarhood and its mundane purpose. He is again perplexed by the words in which Krishna continues to reconcile action and renunciation of action, and asks once again for a decisive statement of that which is the best and highest, not this mingled word. When he realizes fully the nature of the yoga which he is bidden to embrace, his pragmatic nature, accustomed to act from mental will and preference and desire, is appalled by its difficulty, and he asks, "What is the end of the soul which attempts and fails? Whether it does not lose both, this life of human activity and thought and emotion which it has left behind, and the Brahmic consciousness to which it aspires, and falling from both perish like a dissolving cloud? When his doubts and perplexities are resolved, and he knows that it is the divine which must be his law, he aims again and always at such clear and decisive knowledge as will guide him practically to this source and this rule of his future action. How is the divine to be distinguished among the various states of being which constitute our ordinary experience? What are the great manifestations of its self-energy in the world in which he can recognize and realize it by meditation? May he not see even now the divine cosmic form of that which is actually speaking to him through the veil of the human mind and body? And his last questions demand a clear distinction between renunciation of works and this subtler renunciation he is asked to prefer. The actual difference between Purusha and Prakriti, the field and the knower of the field, so important for the practice of desireless action under the drive of the divine will. And finally, a clear statement of the practical operations and results of the three modes of Prakriti which he is bidden to surmount. To such a disciple, the teacher of the Gita gives his divine teaching. He seizes him at a moment of his psychological development by egoistic action, when all the mental, moral, emotional values of the ordinary egoistic and social life of man have collapsed in a sudden bankruptcy. And he has to lift him up out of this lower life into a higher consciousness, out of ignorant attachment to action into that which transcends, yet originates and orders action, out of ego into self, out of life in mind, vitality and body, into that higher nature beyond mind, which is the status of the divine. He has at the same time to give him that for which he asks and for which he is inspired to seek by the guidance within him, a new law of life and action, high above the insufficient rule of the ordinary human existence with its endless conflicts and oppositions, perplexities and illusory certainties, a higher law by which the soul shall be free from this bondage of works and yet powerful to act and conquer in the vast liberty of its divine being. For the action must be performed. The world must fulfill its cycles, and the soul of human being must not turn back in ignorance from the work it is here to do. The whole course of the teaching of the Gita is determined and directed, even in its widest wheelings, towards the fulfillment of these three objects.